So the solutions are on the homepage. I forgot to get the statistics. I'll put it up on the blog. For the next couple of days, anything that I want to tell the class would be on the blog, because the mailing list is down. My machine is down, so that I cannot send you mail on the mailing list. So I'll just put it up on the blog. That's how the last two. So that's why I put those also there. So I'll also put the statistics for the homework too on that. Okay. Then there's also, if you are curious, there is like statistics from the class survey that I did a couple of weeks back. All the statistics of that are here. You can look it up too. Okay. Questions? Are there any questions on the things that we were discussing last class? I'm going to continue discussion of the logical inference. So last time we talked about the general ideas of logical inference, logic in general, which has syntax and semantics, and then what does it mean to talk about entailment in any logic, and entailment ultimately grounded in terms of model theory. So if you are considering the, you would say that a fact is entailed if it holds to be true in every model, every world where the knowledge base holds true. So in fact, the best way to think of knowledge is as constraining the world that you could possibly be in. Okay, if I don't tell you anything, then you could be in possibly any possible world. But now I say Rav is wearing brown shirt, then you are only in those worlds where Rav is wearing brown shirt. Everything else is fine, but Rav must be wearing brown shirt in your world. Okay. So as you add one more sentence saying, you know, the microphone is on, then you have essentially constrained some of the previous worlds which were consistent with Rav wearing brown shirt are no longer consistent with Rav wearing brown shirt as well as microphone being on. So as you add sentences, you are cutting down the number of worlds. Okay. So a knowledge base, the set of worlds where the knowledge base holds, let's say is this, then you would say a particular new sentence is entailed if it holds in all those worlds. If it holds in all those worlds, okay? So actually, let me just make sure that the Venn diagram is clear here. So these here are the set of worlds where the knowledge base holds, okay? And this here is the set of worlds where alpha holds, okay? Alpha is still entailed because in every one of the worlds where the knowledge base holds, alpha does hold. That's it. It could be true in other worlds too, but what's important is it is true in every one of the worlds where the knowledge base holds. Okay. And so that's the notion of entailment. You can compute entailment directly in terms of models. If you, you know, in some logics, the number of models is finite, and so you can essentially enumerate the worlds in which the knowledge base holds and check in each of those worlds whether the sentence you want to entail, to prove to be true actually holds. Okay. But it's much easier to actually also have inference procedures, which are sort of shortcuts, which look at the sentence formation, sentence in syntactically, and say whether it will be, you know, given two sentences, given some group of sentences, by syntactic manipulation, you would say some other sentence holds. Okay, an example for that, as I said last time, was mod exponents. A implies B is true in your logic, in your propositional logic database, and A is true, then you get to write B. And so you say, you would say B is derived. And normally the idea is that when you have something like A implies B, A, you wrote B, then you normally say that this knowledge base, KB, derives B. Okay. And you separate, so this is called the derivation sign, the usual by convention. And by model theory, you define entailment. And the question is to make sure that ultimately the truth, the entailment is defined by model theory. And to use an inference rule, you have to make sure that that inference rule is consistent with what the entailment would have said. Okay. So we talked about soundness and completeness of an inference rule. A rule is sound, an inference rule is sound if when it adds a sentence to the, when it derives a sentence, then it is actually entailed. Okay? And it's complete if every entailed sentence is derivable by this procedure. Okay? So this was all done at the higher level, general high level. And then, so as I said, you know, this is the soundness and completeness of inferences. And then we're going to talk about one example logic, which is the simplest one, and then start from there and do more discussion. So the first one we'll talk about is propositional logic. But before going there, let's kind of look at the big picture. Any logic essentially kind of can be thought of in terms of the kind of commitments it makes about the world and about the truth. Okay? So there are nice big words for it, ontological commitment, which is essentially what does the logic, what is the commitment logic is making as to what the world is made up of. What are the things? Ontology are basically the things in the world. Okay? What does this logic think the world is made up of? Okay? And epistemological commitment is what does this logic think about truth? Okay? Here are some examples, many of which, some of which we'll actually discuss in this class in detail, but all of which you probably heard of at different times in your life. Okay. So propositional logic, which is the simplest logic that you know of, it makes the ontological commitment that world is made up of assertions which are either true or false. That's what propositional logic thinks. Propositional logic doesn't think that it's made up of people or objects or any such thing. It just thinks that the world is made up of truth, assertions, which can be true or false. Okay? And then its commitment regarding truth is that a sentence could either be true given what you know, could be false given what you know, could be unknown given what you know. Okay? That's basically the commitment. Now, you go from, so in some sense that's a bedrock logic, propositional logic. From propositional logic, you can either increase, you can kind of generalize your epistemological commitment or ontological commitment or both and get more interesting logic. Okay? So for example, if you start thinking about a sentence being, instead of, you know, if you want to change the epistemological commitment and say, I will no longer talk about truth, true, false, or unknown, but I will talk about degree. So the degree of belief in that statement. Given the world I know, what's the degree of belief? Given the knowledge base, what is my degree of belief in this statement? So this is essentially the idea is that if your knowledge base KB is consistent with world W1 to W100. Okay. Now, and suppose you have fact F1, F2, F3. Okay. F1 not true in W7, but otherwise true. Okay. F2 not true in W1 to W99 otherwise true. Okay, and F3 true in W1 to W100. Propositional logic would say F3 truth is known. Okay, furthermore, actually, let me write one more thing. F4 false in W1 to W100. Propositional logic would say, given my knowledge base, F3 is entailed to be true. F4 is entailed to be false. That means not F4 is entailed. Okay? But propositional logic would say F1 and F2 are unknown. Because they are neither always false nor always true in the models of the world. Some models are true, some models are false. Okay, and as I was saying, it would make sense to differentiate between F1 and F2. F1 seems to be sort of true in every model of the knowledge base except W7, whereas F2 seems to be true in only one of the worlds where knowledge base is true, but everywhere else it's actually not true. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you would like to make differentiate between F1 and F2, but propositional logic cannot. It will say both of them are unknown. And this one, F3 is entailed, this one not F4 is entailed. By the way, you better understand this. Given a knowledge base, just because a fact is not entailed by the knowledge base, it does not mean that the negation of that fact is entailed. Do you understand? So here, neither F1 is entailed, in both these cases, in propositional logic, neither F1 is entailed, nor not F1 is entailed. Neither F2 is entailed, nor not F2 is entailed. Okay, you don't get to exclude the middle. Unknown is possible. If it's not true in all, or if it's not false in all, then it's unknown. Okay. So you want to actually count the models in some sense, and say degree of belief you have. Okay, then you would actually start saying the epistemological commitment is no longer true, false, unknown, but my degree of belief. That means in some sense, think of it as the fraction of the world in which the knowledge base holds where my fact holds. Okay, if it is 1, that means in some sense F is entailed. If it is 0, that means in some sense not F is entailed. If it is anywhere in between, you know, it's sort of what would have been called unknown by propositional logic, you are actually differentiating them. Do you understand? So in this particular case, I would say that the degree of belief for this, if you make the epistemological commitment to degree of belief, then that's strictly more general than this. So in the probabilistic propositional logic, the ontological commitment is still fact. The world is still made up of facts. Okay. However, the truth, you are going to assess the truth as a degree of belief. That is the percentage of words in which the knowledge base holds where the sentence holds. That's what you're going to assess. Okay. And clearly, this is more general because, in fact, the degree of belief for F3 is 1.0, degree of belief for F4 is 0.0, degree of belief for F1 would be kind of 0.99 something, and exactly 0.99, and degree of belief for F2 would be 0.01. Okay, and you can clearly see that there are, if you kind of generalize your epistemological commitment to hold this one, you are in better shape because you're going to be able to talk about worlds where there is uncertainty. You know, otherwise you are kind of thinking of F1 and F2 both being in the same boat. Okay? So not surprisingly, propositional logic is the simplest logic, and if you just change degree of the epistemological commitment to degree of belief, then you get probabilistic propositional logic, which is actually more useful than propositional logic. You will see that there are very few places where you can directly use propositional logic. But it turns out there are a lot more places where you can use probabilistic propositional logic. And similarly, you could also go on this angle. In fact, I should have made this picture in sort of a two-dimensional. Okay, propositional, if you have two dimensions, ontological commitment, epistemological commitment, then probabilistic logic is sort of, propositional logic is sort of in one corner, and then probabilistic propositional logic is moving on the epistemological commitment side. Okay, and first order predicate logic is moving only on the ontological commitment side. What does first order predicate logic say? It says the world is not made up of facts. It's made up of objects and the relations between objects. It turns out that's a more general statement than thinking that the world is made up of facts. Because if you believe that the world is made up of objects and relations between them, you can always subsume the commitment that world is made up of facts. Because a particular relation holds between a particular set of objects, that would be an assertion. Yes, no. Do you understand what I'm saying? So again, the picture that we have in mind here is here, ontological commitment, epistemological commitment, ontological commitment. And propositional logic is sort of, let's say here, where world is made up of true and false statements, and the truth is made up of known and unknown. And then, the probabilistic propositional logic is here. First order logic, first order deterministic logic is here. And if you want to generalize both, you will come here. That would be first order probabilistic logic, where you say the world is made up of objects and relations, and the truth is a degree of belief. Okay? And you can clearly see as you start generalizing your commitments, you can do more and more. It's a richer and richer modeling language. Okay? So think of these as low level versus higher level computer languages. Okay? Propositional logic is the assembly language. First order logic can be thought of as your favorite higher level language, which oftentimes can be compiled down during implementation, during actual execution. You probably compile it down to propositional logic. But you would like to write programs in higher order languages because it's so much easier to model the world in those languages. Now, it turns out that you can make other extra commitments too. It's not just these two. So for example, temporal logic is a first order logic which makes an extra commitment, which says not only there are objects and relations between the objects, but there is also a special thing called time. Okay, it's just take for granted that there is time, and then time is first class object in this logic. It's not an indirect object. Okay, so clearly, if you're trying to model a world where time is important, then you are better off modeling it in temporal logic than in first order logic because it comes with primitives that directly handle time. Okay? So that's sort of the way you can talk about, you know, different kinds of logic. Okay? One other thing, of course, is fuzzy logic, which a lot of you probably heard of. So the question is, how does fuzzy logic differ from probabilistic logic? It's very important difference. As you can see here, probabilistic logic makes the ontological commitment to facts. Okay? Fuzzy logic makes ontological commitment to degrees of truth. There is no true and false even in a single word. See, the reason you get degree of belief here is because in the individual world, F1 is either true or false. In the individual worlds, F1 is either true or false. But if you look at the fraction of worlds it is true, it's 0.99 or 0.01. Suppose in the individual world itself, F1 is 0.32. Then you are talking about fuzzy logic. Okay, even in a single word, you're talking about degree of truth. So my classic example that I think somewhere I read, probably it's in the textbook, is this idea of you have a big bucket of spotted puppies and white puppies, or brown puppies and white puppies, okay, and a big bucket of them, and you close your eyes and you pick one puppy, okay. Now the question is, what is its color before you open your eyes? What's its color? Suppose there are 95 brown puppies and 5 white puppies. Before you open your eyes, the color is, you think you're 95% certain that it's a brown puppy. Did I say brown is 95%? Okay, so 95% certain that it's a brown puppy. And that 5% certain that it's a white puppy. But once you open your eyes, you know the world you are in. It's either brown or white. It's not in between. Now, if these puppies grew up and had some fun and had kids, okay, and they're also part of this big bucket now, okay, and now, of course, there are some puppies whose color is sort of pigmentation is somewhere in between white and brown. So then, in fact, the color itself is neither, so if you think of white as, the brown as true and white as false, let's say, then once you have puppies with their own kids, they actually have color somewhere in between. So their degree of truth has changed. So it's kind of a nice little anecdote to keep in mind as to how fuzzy logic differs from probabilistic logic. In the end, probabilistic logic assumes that given a world, the fact is either true or false. The uncertainty comes in terms of what is the percentage of worlds where it's true. Okay? So keep this bigger picture in mind, and we'll start talking with propositional logic. We'll talk about its syntax, we'll talk about its semantics, we'll talk about resolution, we'll talk about inference in it. And then we will at least look at this and this, extension to probabilistic propositional logic, extension to first order logic. We would not look at this because this is at the very bleeding edge. Right now, we don't have very good undergraduate level treatments of first order probabilistic logic. It's a very hot topic of research. Okay? And to understand the sort of the how long it took for us to reason with logics, it's just amazing to realize that, all recorded history, starting from Greeks, were talking about syllogisms and logical reasoning. The first sound and complete inference procedure for first order logic, which is essentially a generalization of the resolution principle I talked about last class, and I'll repeat again today, the generalization of resolution principle to first order logic. That has been found, when? Given that we've been thinking about as humans, we've been thinking about logic forever. It's only been found in 1962. Resolution, the sound and complete inference procedure for first order logic was found by Alan Robinson in 1962. Okay, so given that, it's not surprising that we don't yet have a clean understanding of first order probabilistic logic. But you do know, why this would be useful to have. It's one thing understanding why it's useful to have, another thing actually having it. And we still are working on having it right now. Okay. So propositional logic, syntax. So we'll look at some examples of, as I said, propositional logic as an example of the simplest logic. So it has syntax. I'm assuming all of you heard about this stuff. You have proposition symbols, P1, P2, etc., they themselves become sentences, because the only ontological commitment is that there are statements in the world that are either true or false in every world, in each world. So you can give them propositional symbols as these statements. And then you have, how do you write syntactically valid sentences? Those are the rules for the syntactically valid sentences. If S is a sentence, then negation of S is a sentence. If S1 and S2 are sentences, then S1 conjunction S2 is a sentence. If S1 and S2 is a sentence, then the disjunction is a sentence, and the implication is a sentence, and also this. Now, among these, really, if you really talk about what are the most important things, this one, this one, this one. Everything else is derived. Because if I say S1 implies S2, I can write it as not S1 or S2. What do I mean by that is actually going to be explained. I mean, you know this already. S1 implies S2 is logically equivalent to not S1 or S2, but that's because ultimately to do with semantics. Okay, in propositional logic, every logic has to say given, at the minimum, every logic has to say given a word and a sentence, you have to be able to tell whether that sentence holds true or false in that word. Assuming you're already told the truth and falsity values of individual proposition statements. In the case of propositional logic, if I tell you the truth and falsity values of all the propositional statements, then any arbitrary sentence made up of these statements, you should be able to look at the world and say, yeah, it's true, this is false. There is no in between. Given a word, there is no in between for a sentence. Okay, so, and these are the rules that you would use to tell. Okay, so the basic rules essentially are, you have to start with the truth falsity values for the proposition, and then for every sentence, the truth of a sentence is determined this way. If S is false, then negation of S is true. Now, so if P is given to be true in your world, then not P, the sentence not P is false. That's all I'm saying. Okay. And similarly, if S1 is true and S2 is true, then S1 and S2 is true. And similarly, S1 is true, or S2 is true, S1 or S2 is true. Notice that R here is not exclusive R, it's just an inclusive R. It allows both S1 and S2 both to be true. Okay? And then S1 implies S2 is true if S1 is false or S2 is true. In fact, what it's saying is, if S1 is true, then S2 must be true. Okay. And then this one is just a conjunction of S1 implies S2 and S2 implies S1. These are well-known rules that you have seen in multiple different times in your life for propositional logic. Okay. So now what we want to do is, given this, I'm ready now to talk about entailment computation. Okay. So if I have n propositions in that I'm using to model my world, if I have 100 propositions to model my world, let's say P1 to P100, right? A complete world is given by providing truth falsity interpretation to every one of these propositions. In each of those worlds, and so there are obviously, for this 100 propositions, there are 2^100 possible complete worlds. And each one of them, you know for sure whether any arbitrary sentence made up of P1 to P100 is either true or false. It's not in between. Okay? The interesting things come, of course, if I don't tell you the truth falsity values of P1 to P100. Instead, I will tell you a knowledge base, KB, which says either P or Q is true, and Q is definitely not true. And it's asking, do you know anything about P? Okay. So now what happens, as we know, is that this really corresponds to not a single world, but some set of worlds. And in essence, in all of those worlds, you have to check whether P holds. If P holds in all of those worlds, it's entailed. If not, it's unknown. It's not entailed. Okay? And we talked about how to do this using model theory versus proof theory. The simplest one is model theory. And in the case of propositional logic, the models can be written out as each model is a truth table, is a row in the truth table. Okay? So if you have A, B, and C as your propositions, A, B, and C as your propositions, then these are the possible worlds, false, 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 blah, 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 true, true, true. There are 2^3, 8 worlds. Okay? Now, the knowledge base here is the following. Either A or C, so A or C is true, and B or not C is true. And I want to check, whether A or B is entailed by this. Knowing this, can I be sure that A or B is always true if I know that in my world this is true? Okay? And the simplest thing, of course, is to write down the models. So I wrote down in this particular case, using the simple rules of propositional logic, for each of these interpretations, the value for ARC, value for BR not C, and so the value for the conjunction, which is the value for the knowledge base. Okay? And so these, so where are the worlds where the knowledge base holds? This. So really, by saying these two sentences, you said of the 8 possible worlds, you can only really be in these 4 worlds. The question then is, if in every one of these 4 worlds is alpha true, is the world true, alpha is at the edge. If any one of these cases alpha is not true, then alpha is not entailed. Now notice that I don't care whether alpha is true in other places too. For example, knowledge base is false here, alpha is still true. I don't care. Because knowledge base tells me the set of worlds I might be in. And in all those worlds alpha is holding, then alpha is entailed. I can add alpha as something that also is known about the world I live in. Okay, very simple. Alpha is true in all worlds where knowledge base is true, so it's entailed. Okay? Another way you could do this, if you don't feel like counting, you know, each row, you could add an extra column, which is knowledge base and negation of alpha. Knowledge base and negation of alpha. If alpha is entailed, it must be the case that that column should be all false all the time. In every world it better be false. Right? And in fact that's the case. Okay. So in some sense what you are saying is, if you believe in the knowledge base, you cannot not believe in alpha. There is no world where you can have the knowledge base true and alpha not true. So you might as well add alpha to your knowledge base, because it's just in every world where you know what you know about what you know in the knowledge base is true, alpha is true. Okay? And this is actually a nice way to check alpha. So basically, this is what's called a model theoretic entailment. Now, here I'm actually showing it on the way to talking about how to do inference directly using syntactic methods. But in propositional logic, you can do model theoretic entailment. If you feel like, you can actually do it automatically. Because these tables are finite. They could be huge, but they are finite. Okay? And it turns out that this is actually, do you guys know the following problem? Given a set of propositional formulas, question, is there a satisfying assignment? I give you a bunch of propositional formulas. Okay? I want to ask you, is there, these are propositional formulas made up of, let's say, letters P1 to P100. All I want to know is there a specific assignment of truth falsity values to P1 to P100, okay, such that all these formulas will evaluate to true under that assignment. What is this probability, this problem called? Satisfiability problem. How hard is it? it's the prototypical NP-hard problem. It's the prototypical NP-complete problem, in fact. Okay. Now, suppose I told you that, in fact, we'll come back to this and talk about special versions of this, which can be polynomial. Okay. In particular, it turns out, we'll see in a minute, that every propositional formula can be written in terms of canonical representation, either as a CNF or DNF, conjunctive normal form or disjunctive normal form representation. And a conjunctive normal form representation is of the following, the formulas will be of the following form, PR not Q or J, not J, MR J. So every formula in your database would look like this. It turns out that, show you in a minute that irrespective of the kind of sentences I give you, with implications, without implications, etc., I can always convert that into a knowledge base which is equivalent to this form. So in fact, a version of satisfiability problem that you may have heard of is, given a set of propositional clauses, is there a satisfying assignment? And the clauses they are talking about are the CNF clauses. Now, if I tell you that I'm going to look for clauses of size at most one, so my knowledge base is made up of clauses whose size is at most one. How hard is it to find the satisfying assignment? That means each clause is either empty, which basically means upfront it's false, it can never be made true, or it's like either P or Q or M. And so you just, whatever is written in the formula, those are the ones that must be true. So it's very easy to find. So this is called one set. So clause length one or lower, one set. One set, cheap to compute. How about two set? If I can ask you for clauses of length, if all the clauses are of length 2 or less, every clause is of length 2 or less, then what happens? That's two set. It turns out that too is polynomial. You can actually compute the satisfying assignment in polynomial time. Then comes three set. That is, all clauses are of length 3 or less. That's the first NP-complete set problem. Three set and above are all NP-complete. Two set and one set are cheap. Okay. The reason I brought this up is, first of all, there's a lot of interest in computing satisfying assignments, and satisfiability is a bedrock problem in computer science. And in fact, I won't go into it now, but the technology for computing satisfying assignment for large number of clauses has improved tremendously in the past few years. So much so that you can do millions of clauses, and I think little less than millions of variables. Variables means propositions, under minutes. So you can't even see the huge formula in front of you, it's so big. And yet there are programs which will parse and tell you, yes, here is a satisfying assignment. No, there is no satisfying assignment. In fact, it's easier to solve these problems if there is a satisfying assignment. What problem does this actually remind you of? In fact, there is one of the very effective methods for solving satisfiability problems is something that we have actually discussed already in the class. One way of computing the satisfiability assignment for a set of formulas is, remember, ultimately, if you have P1 to P100, then the solution would be true-false assignment to these 100 variables. Pick one. Let's say P1 is true, P2 is false, P3 is true, P4 is false, etc. That's a complete assignment. Check if all the clauses are satisfied with respect to that assignment. If they are, you are the luckiest kid on the block, you're done. If not, you have to tweak this assignment. You have to flip somebody's value. The question is, whose value should I flip? you can either flip P1s or P2s or P100s. I would say flip the guy whose flip would increase the number of satisfiable clauses by the maximum amount. So you do the simulation. Let me flip P1 and see. So suppose originally the number of clauses that are satisfied is 20%. Okay. And let me flip P1, now 30% are satisfied. P2, 19% are satisfied. P3, some other percent are satisfied. So you pick the variable whose flipping will increase, will lead to the maximum number of clauses satisfied. Commit to that. Now flip again until you reach all clauses satisfied. This reminds you of what problem we talked in this class. What? Yeah, but I mean, there was an exact problem for hill climbing. Mm-hmm. Queens, 8 queens problem, n queens problem. And the specific algorithm I just described to you is min conflict algorithm. And min conflict based algorithms for satisfiability are some of the fastest algorithms. They can really, really solve large size problems. Very simple. Now, having brought this whole thing up, I want to ask you, if I gave you the hill climbing algorithm for finding the satisfiability assignment, can I then use it to do the entailment check? You know that satisfiability and entailment are connected, right? Because this thing essentially is saying, if I can always convert satisfiability, entailment problem into conjugate of satisfiability problem. That is, if a set of clauses has no satisfying assignment, then the final clause I added to come up with this knowledge base, the negation of that is actually entailed. So that's what I did. You know, KB and not alpha has no satisfying assignment, so alpha is really entailed. So satisfiability and entailment are yin and yang. Okay, they are conjugate problems. If satisfiability is NP complete, then the conjugate problem would be co-NP complete. So entailment in propositional logic, first of all, is co-NP complete. Okay. And the second question is, if I have a satisfiability solver, I should be able to use it to compute entailment. And I've been making this big deal about how there are fast satisfiability solvers. And in particular, I told you about this min conflict based satisfiability solver, which is very fast. Can I use it to compute entailment? Hill climbing is good at finding a solution with some good probability. It's very bad at proving that there is no solution. Because to be able to prove there is no solution, you have to exhaust the search space. Hill climbing has no memory, so it doesn't know whether it's exhausted the search space. In fact, one of the homework questions that you just got back is, even on finite trees, hill climbing never has to terminate. Because it can keep going around to the same place it's been to, because it has no memory. The lack of its lack of memory is its flexibility as well as its bane. Okay, so it turns out that the simple algorithm based on min conflict, which works wonders for satisfying, is not good for entailment, because it cannot show you that there doesn't exist any satisfying assignment. When hill climbing doesn't come back, it could either be because it's sign of cycling or because there is really no satisfying assignment. I want a proof, not if. Okay. So it turns out that if you want to do model theoretic entailment checks, you would need a systematic SAT solver. A SAT solver which would exhaust the entire space. It in essence ultimately looks at, if there are P1 to P100 propositions, it would in essence ultimately look at and prove to itself that none of the 2^100 assignments would have worked. Okay? So all of this is kind of interesting because this is connected to SAT, which is connected to min conflicts based, like the kind of 8 queen sorts of problems. And you could solve it using hill climbing or systematic search. But if you want to solve the entailment, you have to use systematic method. Okay? Because again, this is a general point. Hill climbing methods are bad if you want to use the search to prove that there is no solution. They're very good if you want to use the search to prove that there is a solution. They're bad to prove the opposite. Okay? So that's all about model theoretic entailment. Let's look at the inference rules for propositional logic. We looked at these. Some of the inference rules are these: the modus ponens, the modus tollens, the chaining rule. This is abduction and it's not sound. How do you prove that something is sound? How do you prove that an inference rule is sound or not sound? You have to essentially compute, you have to put the truth table based entailment check and show that if you have A implies B and A, that's just two variables, A and B. So there's a four row truth table. Okay? Compute the set of rows where the conjunction of these formulas holds to be true. And make sure that in each of those rows, B is true. In which case, you are allowed to write B directly. You have proved it once, so you can always do it syntactically. So that's how you will actually prove that something is a sound inference procedure. So an example that you should try at home is to show that abduction is not a sound procedure. So what would happen essentially is, so in this case, there would be worlds where the knowledge base is true and yet not B is not true. That's what you would prove. Right? Okay. Now we talked about how there are so many sound ones. Now to show that it's complete, what do you need to do? It's actually easy to show that something is not complete, because you give an example where model theoretically you can see the entailment, but this formula doesn't show it. And that's what we were looking at last class when we ended. And so we come back there. So here is a scenario where it's clear to you, I guess, but you can also show it. You don't have to depend on your intuition. You can write the truth table and show that essentially J holds if in your world W implies J and not W implies J, both are true in your world, then J is entailed. Okay? Now the question of course is, modus ponens obviously cannot derive it, neither can modus tollens by itself. All of them together can derive it. You can actually prove it, show it to yourself, that you combine, you do some modus ponens, some modus tollens, you would be able to derive J, and some case analysis. Okay? But the question is there a single rule? And we said we have this rule called resolution rule, which is a strict generalization of everything that you have seen in propositional logic until now, which essentially says if you have alpha or beta, where alpha and beta are proposition symbols, and not beta or gamma, then you get to remove beta and not beta and write alpha or gamma into the knowledge base. That's the inference rule. And the first thing is you can show that this is sound by showing that there are 1, 2, 3 propositions. So you have a 8-row truth table in which you can count the words, you can look at the words where these two together are true and convince yourself that in all those words alpha or gamma is also true. That's the only way you actually convince yourself. That's the way to prove soundness of the inference. Okay? Now it turns out that this is more general than anything else that we have seen. So for example, the rule of modus ponens is really a special case. Why is it a special case? Why is it a special case of resolution? Because if I have A implies B and A, then this becomes not A or B, and this becomes A. If I resolve those, this dot goes off and I get B. Okay? The same thing for modus tollens. If A implies B, not B is true, you know that not A must be true, right? And if I convert this into A implies B is not A or B, and then not B, you resolve these two, you get not A. Very powerful rule. I mean, if it's the first time you're seeing resolution, it's kind of fun because everything else that you always do is just a special case of resolution rule. Okay. Now, the resolution rule actually is complete, and the proof for completeness has to go by induction. Look at the textbook to make sure that you, if you're interested in getting the proof for propositional case. It's the proof of completeness of resolution for first-order logic that took from the Greeks to 1962. What Alan Robinson did was to prove that generalization of resolution is complete for first-order logic because it's a nice and big induction proof. And that's the one that, you know, finally got done in 1962. Okay, but the propositional case is easy enough as an inductive proof. You should look it up. Now, how do I use this rule? Basically, all the resolution rule is saying is if you do resolutions and write new formulas that come out, okay, then all those formulas are also entailed. Okay, so in the particular example that we have, I can resolve W or not J and W or J, I'll get J or J. And if I then go ahead and say, oh, J or J is equal to J, this is called factoring. It's one little trick you have to do. Okay? So I said if you keep on doing resolution, but if you keep on doing resolution plus factoring, which is whenever there are things like J or J, you write it as J. If you do just that one thing, simplification, then of course you will realize now that J is entailed. Okay? There's another way of proving this, which is essentially prove, so this is going this way is called forward resolution. So you start from the fact, keep deriving things that will come. Okay? And see if one of the clauses that you entailed is the goal that you're trying, the goal clause that you're trying to entail, in which case you're done. The other one is to be goal directed. Start with what you want to prove and do resolutions that will sort of be guided by the goal. And there's an example for that in the model theoretic entailment. What you need to do is, if you want to prove J, if you believe that J should be entailed and you want to prove that, then assume the opposite. So assume not J and add not J to this database. So W or not W or J, W or J and not J. Then what should happen? If in fact J is entailed, then adding not J should make the database inconsistent. If the database is inconsistent, you should be able to derive the empty clause. Empty clause essentially is a clause which has no proposition, no literal. Okay? And that's actually that's goal directed because you're starting with negation of goal and proving that inconsistency arises. Okay? So that would basically, in this case, you'll add not J and W or not J, W or J and not J will give me W, and that W and not W or J will give me J, and J and not J will give me empty clause. Did you see this, by the way? How many of you saw what I just said? Well, I guess you saw it. I'll show you a bigger example where it's more interesting. But so you would, you know, so in this particular case, You added not J, not W or J, and W or J. Okay? Those were the three formulas you have. This and that, let's say, you would get W. This and this, you would get you J. This and this, you would get your empty clause. Notice that this guy is taking part in a lot of things. That's okay. This guy, if he's true, he's true not just in the first step of the derivation, he's true in the second step as well as the third step. all I need to show is there is an empty class. Now, it looks like there is a problem with this reasoning. Suppose the empty class came because the original database is inconsistent. It has nothing to do with the goal. The original database itself was inconsistent. So original database says P and not P. And of course, J would be entailed. By this formula proposition, you'll be able to show that J is entailed. Is this a problem? No, because the definition of entailment essentially says that if the knowledge base is not true in any world, then vacuously everything is true in the world where the knowledge base is true. So this is like the proverb that says, when you get an A in the class, pigs will start flying. And so in essence, what they're saying is, you getting an A in the class is impossible. There is no world where that would happen, and so pigs will be flying in that world. Okay? So from negation, from empty class, everything follows. Okay? Now, from the inconsistency, everything follows. So that's what we're checking here too. Okay? That's basically what I just showed you. Now, a couple of things before we end today, which is resolution is defined in terms of these clauses. I said, the general form of resolution is actually, it doesn't even have to be, I said earlier that resolution is alpha or gamma and not alpha or beta will give me gamma or beta, right? Actually, it can be A R, B, R, alpha, or gamma, and not alpha, or beta, or delta, or epsilon. And then what would happen? All that would happen is these two, basically, these are the ones that you resolved. Those two would go away. Everything else will come down. Okay, so it is A, R, B, R, gamma, R, beta, R, delta, R, epsilon. So the length of the clause has no bearing. So in particular, you can all you care about is both of them are in this clausal form, where a clause is a disjunction of literals, where a literal is a proposition symbol or its negation. Okay? Now the question is, I have been telling you earlier that proposition logic can have all sorts of funny statements, such as implications, bidirectional implications, negations, and all that stuff. Is it really the case that everything in propositional logic can be converted ultimately to clausal form? That is a question, because if that's not the case, then you can't do resolution on them. It turns out that is true. In fact, in propositional logic, there are two canonical forms. These are basically, there are a bunch of normal forms, some of which are canonical. A canonical normal form is one where you can convert any database into that particular form, any database of propositional sentences into that particular form. And of the two important ones, one is conjunctive normal form, one is disjunctive normal form. Conjunctive normal form is the one we are looking at, which is a conjunction of disjunction of literals. So the knowledge base itself is a conjunction of CNF clauses, where each CNF clause is of this form. DNF is the opposite, where it's a disjunction of conjunction of literals. Given any random propositional database, you can either convert it all the way to CNF or convert it all the way to DNF. That's why they are canonical forms. In particular, we are most interested in converting it into canonical conjunctive normal form. And from those of you who still remember CSE EEE 120, this is the product of sums form, and this is the sum of products form. And those are the canonical forms. Okay? There are other normal forms that are restricted. For example, there's a form called Hahn form, which is an interesting kind of a clause, where the clause can be as long as it can be, as you want, but when you, so Hahn clauses are defined in terms of CNF clauses. So first convert your knowledge base into CNF, and if every clause in that knowledge base then has at most one positive literal, then it's called a Hahn knowledge base. why is Hahn classes interesting? It turns out that if your knowledge base is equivalent to a Hahn class knowledge base, then repeatedly doing mod exponents will get you everything that can be derived. If what you know about the world is completely expressible in terms of a set of Hahn classes, then mod exponents is actually complete for you. Okay? Resolution, and what's more interesting, running mod exponents to completion on any finite size database is polynomial time. Whereas running resolution to completion on any finite size database has to be co-NP complete, because otherwise you're getting something out of nothing. We said resolution is complete. We said satisfiability is NP complete. We said entailment is co-NP complete. So resolution, running resolution must be co-NP complete. Okay. So mod exponents is actually a good thing, and if your world is Hahn knowledge base, then mod exponents can be done. Sometimes what you would do is, even if you have knowledge about the world that cannot be written as a Hahn class, to get done fast and go home, you would find an Hahn approximation to your knowledge. If you do that, then you get to get done fast. Okay, but we'll look at that later. Now, in fact, what's interesting is prolog without variables and without the cut operator is actually doing Hahn class theorem proving. And of course, prolog, I mean, so there better be some very interesting stuff that this cut operator is doing, because otherwise prolog should be doing linear, I mean, polynomial inference. But that's not the case, because prolog is a full programming language. It's Turing equivalent. Okay, so now I said that everything can be converted into CNF form. Here is basically what you need to do. Here's an example and here's a step. So any propositional logical sentence can be converted into CNF form. So for example, not P and Q implies not R or W. This is clearly not in the logic, in a clausal form, but I can still convert into logical form, clausal form, by just repeatedly following some set of steps. First thing, remove implication. Okay? When I do that, A implies B will be written as not A or B. Then pull negation in. If I have not of A or B, pulling negation in essentially means negation should apply to at most one proposition. So if it's not of A or B, then it will become not A and not B. Okay, that's basically the De Morgan's law. That's basically a pulling of negation. And then distribute the disjunction over conjunction. Okay? And then separate each disjunction into a separate class. You're done. Okay, so let me see if I have an example for this here. I didn't have an example here. So in this particular case, I mean, I showed you pieces, but you should be able to do that one. Convert that into, so this would be not of P and Q implies not of R or W. So that will be P and Q are not R or W. Let's do this. How would I convert that? That the first step would be P and Q are not R or W. Okay? So that there is no, and then the negation has to be pulled in here. So this is P and Q are not R and not W. Okay? P and Q are not R and not W. So what do we do now? It's P R not R and P R not W and Q R not R and Q R not W. Now I just remove this conjunction and say this is class 1, class 2, class 3, class 4. Okay? So I can convert any random class into this form. Here is, and if I do this, And, you know, and the normal way you would do the resolution of the theorem proving is by refutation. In the sense, you take what you want to prove, negate it, add it to the database, and chase for the empty clause. That's why we call it the mad chase for the empty clause. All of resolution theorem proving is looking for an empty clause by successive resolution. So here is an example. If the grass is wet, then it is either raining or the sprinkler is on. If it's raining, then Tim is happy. If the sprinkler is on, then Tim is happy. If Tim is happy, then he sings. Tim is not singing. Prove that grass is not wet. Okay? You guys see that it's clear. Let's write this down. So the most obvious way to write this is grass is wet, then it's either raining or sprinkler is on. GW implies R or SP. And raining, then Tim is happy. R implies TH. I'm just making up the proposition names. It doesn't matter. As long as I am consistent. Okay? If sprinklers are on, Tim is happy. SP implies TH. Tim is happy, then he sings. TH implies SG. Tim is not singing, not SG. I need to prove grass is not wet. That means I want to prove not GW. So what do? I add GW to the database. So I added GW to the database. And then I converted the entire database into clausal form. Here is a scenario where everything was easy because this becomes not GW or R or SP. This is not R or TH. This is not SP or TH, not TH or SG, not SG. Then do some resolution. And one thing that you can, one heuristic that you can use is to the extent the inconsistency is going to come because of the negation of the goal, make sure that every resolution you make, a resolution is between a pair of clauses, right? Make sure that every resolution you make is between one clause, which is either the goal clause itself or derived from the goal clause, or another is anybody. Okay? So in every resolution, in every resolution marriage, somebody should be from the goal or the descendant of the goal. If you do this, the number of resolutions you do are reducing. And yet, you're guaranteed to find empty clause if, in fact, G is empty. Right? So that's a heuristic here. So look what happens now. I started with GW as one of the guys in the resolution. So I am doing set of support. This is called set of support. At least one clause should have set of support. And here is the goal clause itself, so this has set of support. And since this guy is got derived from this, so this like set of support is like royal blood. Okay? You'll have royal blood if you are royal to begin with, or one of your parents is royal. And so on and so forth. Okay? So now this is a royal clause. Do that with that. I got R and not R, and I get R and RSP, so I get THRSP. Then I do those two, SGRSP. Then I do those two, I get SP. Then I do those two, I get TH. Then I do those two, I get SG. Then I do those two, I get not SG. Okay, which is basically SG and not SG is an empty clause. That's one proof tree. There may have been a simpler proof tree. I think this is one proof tree definitely, which actually does show that there is an empty clause. Do you think there is search in resolution? If I have like a few more extra sentences thrown in and I say get done in 5 minutes during the exam, do you think you'll be done? If not, then there is search. And you need to control the search. And one way we are controlling the search in this case is we are essentially ensuring that one of the resolvents is always either the goal clause itself or something that's derived from the goal clause. I can cut down the number of resolutions even more if I say one of the clauses must always be from the input. Notice that all these red clauses are non-input clauses. These are derived from the input clauses. Suppose I said every resolution should have at least one clause that's directly from the input. That's called a linear input form heuristic, where at least one clause in every resolution you do is from the input. That reduces the number of resolutions even more. Unfortunately, it's not complete. So there may be theorems that can be proved that can't be proved if you confine yourself only to resolutions where one of the clauses is from the input. But the set of support, which is not as powerful in terms of cutting down the search, is however complete. Okay? It is important, and this is, so that's basically what resolution theorem proving is all about. And let me end with a cautionary tale. Because resolution theorem proving is a mad chase for the empty class, people try to make empty classes out of thin air. During exam, under time stress, people find all sorts of, innovative ways to make an empty class out of nowhere. Okay? A classic one is this. If I resolve PRQ with not PR, not Q, I can always remove one clause and one literal and its negation, right? So the more the merrier. It looks like the two literals and their negation. So just remove both of them and say PR not Q and not PR not Q, empty class. Nah. Because it turns out if in fact two sentences when resolved give empty class, what that means is there is no world where both those sentences can be true. So P or not P resolves to NP class because there is no world where both P is true and not P is true. So the question, to show that this cannot be the case, realize that if P is true and Q is false, in the world where P is true and Q is false, both this guy and this guy are happily true. And yet you said you are inconsistent and cut them out. So again, this is one important thing. The resolution is always with respect to one literal and its negation. So in this particular case, either you can resolve one P and not P, or you can resolve one Q and not Q. Both are doable. But you don't get to resolve both at the same time. And so in fact, you will never be able to get an empty class if your database is this. Yes?
For this specific example, if the second thing is not P and not Q, could we then resolve those two?
Well, if it is PRQ and you are taking the negation of PRQ, okay, then remember that in the resolution it won't be a clause. It would come as two different clauses. So the way what he's saying is PRQ can lead to empty clause if you have two more clauses, one called not P, one called not Q. Did you understand what I'm saying? Because the and would be put as separate sentence. Yes, that's the only place where you get negative class, but that won't be a single class. It will be two different classes. So we'll end here, and then next class, most likely I would do probabilistic propositional logic before coming back to first order deterministic logic.